This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome back to The Bunker, your daily underground refuge from whatever we're calling the contemporary political nightmare. I'm Andrew Harrison. Today, conspiracy theory. It used to be an esoteric interest for odd people on the fringes of society. Then, during Brexit, COVID and the Trump presidency, it migrated into the mainstream, particularly the tangled mess that includes QAnon, Pizzagate and the great replacement theory that white America is going to be erased by immigration. Now, in the UK, we're increasingly seeing politicians coming out with inflammatory, unsourced claims, wild assertions from the fringes and out-and-out falsehoods. In recent weeks, Leigh Anderson, Liz Truss, Labour's disowned Rochdale by-election candidate Azhar Ali and the prominent Brexit supporter Andrew Bridgen MP have all trotted out bizarre theories about the world, from Islamist and deep state conspiracies to the idea that Israel stood back and allowed the October the 7th attacks to deeply odd theories about COVID and the power of the UN. Are we seeing our MPs becoming more susceptible to dark fantasies about plots and secret control? And if so, why? Here to talk about it is Tom Phillips, co-author with friend of the podcast John Elledge of Conspiracy, A History of Bollocks Theories and How Not to Fall for Them, a book that evidently no MP has read. Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm not bad. So let's talk about a couple of those instances I mentioned at the top. Andrew Bridgen has been suspended from the Tory party over comparing the COVID intervention to the Holocaust. Recently, at a Commons debate on heart disease, he blamed the COVID vaccine for instances of heart attacks. He's also retweeting a strange shopping list of conspiracy, which turned out to be entirely false, which claimed to be a UN document. What has gone on with Bridgen? He's gone very strange.
Yeah. So, I mean, as you said in the introduction, we've seen a lot of elected politicians sort of really walking up to the line of outright fringe conspiracy theory stuff recently. Andrew Bridgen is the one who's really walked all the way over that line. You know, he is kind of the outlier in this, in that he's gone full vaccine truther. You know, the reason he was suspended from the Tory party a while back was because, you know, he said that it was the greatest crime since the Holocaust, you know, managing that, hit that sweet spot of being dangerously wrong about the vaccine and offensive about the Holocaust at the same time, you know, which was too much for the Tory party to bear. And yeah, sort of since then, he's kind of really continued down this path and he's really, really doubled down onto it. And as you said, you know, just sort of the other week, he was tweeting this document that's been going around on the fringes of the internet for years, which is a complete fake, that the UN is planning, you know, sort of one world government, the end of private property, depopulation, microchips in every person, 5G, government-raised children, there's this massive list. And, you know, it's absurd. Like, even if the UN was doing this, they wouldn't write it down on a helpful list.
What has gone wrong with Bridgen? Because he's, I mean, there was a story in the Times the other day, his estranged wife saying that he's been radicalised and captured by an anti-vax cult. She says she and her son were left homeless and living off benefits after the sect took over Bridgen and destroyed their marriage.
Yeah, and look, I don't want to sort of speculate about, you know, him in and of himself. There is always this sort of difficult push and pull when you're talking about conspiracy theories, in the people who are espousing them are both, you know, doing something very bad in spreading these things, but are also in their own way, you know, kind of victims as well.
Yeah.
And, you know, the situation that his estranged wife is describing there is one that is echoed in families across the country, you know, particularly during the pandemic. Lots and lots of people got lost down these rabbit holes. In some ways, it shouldn't actually be that much of a surprise to us that, you know, out of 600 plus MPs in Parliament, one of them went down a similar rabbit hole, you know. But it is the case that because conspiracy theories have this sort of inbuilt logic that anybody who contradicts the theory is part of the conspiracy, they're very, very resistant to any kind of evidence or argument against them. they are really, really powerful at dividing families, making people turn against those who are closest to them, those who could potentially pull them out of a downward spiral. And as I say, you know, it is very sad. And I don't want to speculate about what's happened to Bridgen himself, but it is fairly clear that he's gone really quite far down that rabbit hole.
Some politicians who haven't gone quite so far down that sort of a rabbit hole, but are perhaps more dangerous. So I mentioned Lee Anderson saying that Sadiq Khan had handed over control of London to his mates with the kind of implication that there was some sort of Islamist conspiracy around this. There's been a long-standing racist kind of drumbeat against Khan as the most prominent Muslim politician in the country. But a majority of Tory members said that Anderson shouldn't have been suspended for what he said. Does conspiracy talk become a way of sort of articulating that they're saying what the mainstream won't let you? They're using their platform to get into the public square. That stuff that's somehow being suppressed somewhere.
Yeah, there's this sort of strange push and pull that you see with conspiracy theories a lot of the time, is that they're basically attempts to make concrete, make evidenced things that are basically emotional impulses.
Yeah.
You know, like the idea that somehow Sadiq Khan, a liberal Muslim who is, you know, proud to be the mayor of a multicultural cosmopolitan city, that he is somehow not of us, that he is of the other. Like, that has been bubbling under for, you know, very, very long time. There's a huge number of conspiracy theories that attach themselves to Sadiq Khan. There's a really widespread theory that his election, which was overwhelming both times as mayor of London, was entirely based on voter fraud, you know, voter fraud coming from the Muslim population of the capital. And so there is this sort of sense that conspiracy theories are a way to say and make concrete the things that people sort of feel deep in their gut in some sort of way. And they're looking for a sort of a narrative that gives voice to that feeling. And I think the thing with Anderson is it is straightforwardly conspiracist to say that, you know, Sadiq Khan is automatically mates with Islamists, that he has given control of London over to them. That is a very, very classic conspiracy theory that sort of posits that, you know, merely in the sense that you can be identified with a group means that you are working in secret with that group. You know, and it's something that's been targeted, obviously, an awful lot at Muslims in recent times. You go back through history, it's also something that's been targeted at Jews. It's something that's been targeted at Catholics. It's been targeted at a huge number of minorities, and particularly ones who are descended from immigrant populations.
It's interesting. We talked about on a couple of the podcasts that Suella Braverman said effectively exactly the same thing as Lee Anderson, just in more politic language. The truth is that the Islamists, the extremists, and the anti-Semites are in charge now. It's very interesting that you know, I'd love to see that particular committee meeting where the Islamists, the extremists, and the anti-Semites are all trying to get something done. But you know, you talk about people knowing where the line is. Braverman seems to be quite an expert on the line.
Yeah, and it's always a trick. You know, you sort of see these politicians kind of like, you know, going out sort of with statements, and they're just giving enough ambiguity. They're just giving enough, like, and I say, they're in charge now is a phrase that can be read literally, but also we often use it, you know, we use it sort of metaphorically, like, you know, the lunatics are in charge of the asylum kind of phrasing. And so, like, yeah, she's used a bit of phrasing there that is just one step slightly more ambiguous than he has got, you know, Islamists have got control of London. He has actually given our capital city away to his mates. I don't quite, you know, to be clear, I don't quite get why that's a line, but it is fairly clear that you can see that there is some sort of line there, and that Anderson sort of galumped over it while Braverman's just keeping back this side of it.
Yeah. And it's been interesting over the past couple of weeks to see Truss at the CPAC conference trotting out not exactly the full slate of Trumpist conspiracy theory, but certainly the core one, that there is the deep state. You know, we've had murmuring about the blob in Britain's right-wing papers and the fringes of the Conservative Party for several years now. Is the notion of the deep state becoming like the Conservative comfort blanket to excuse their failure to actually get anything done over the past decade and a half?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. This is the thing. It's like the deep state is a conspiracy theory because it is so amorphous. It's very hard to pin down. What do you actually mean? You know, sort of when you say the blob is in charge, what does that actually mean? In Liz Truss's case, I mean, you know, you can't see to what extent, you know, she's going on like sort of Steve Bannon's you know, podcasts and stuff like that. I don't know to what extent she's playing up to what she thinks the right-wing audience in America wants to hear, or whether or not this is genuinely what she believes. It's worth stating straight out, the problem was not what she said, that the deep state thwarted her attempts to put her policies into place. The deep state didn't thwart her attempts to put her policies into place. She put her policies into place, and that's what went wrong. If the deep state had thwarted her attempts to put her policies in place, there's every chance that she'd still be prime minister today. She deliberately, you know, she sacked the chief civil servant at the Treasury so that he wouldn't stop her doing her mini budget. She went round the Office for Budget Responsibility so that they wouldn't get in the way. She specifically rooted around these things that she's now claiming are the deep state who thwarted her. If she'd actually listened to them, then, you know, maybe things might have gone slightly better for her. But yeah, there is definitely this sort of sense that, you know, we're told that the deep state is in charge. We're told that the blob is in charge. Yeah, it's a political party that's been in charge of the country for nigh on 14 years now. No one else is to blame for anything that's going wrong. And conspiracy theories do provide this really, really convenient sort of get-out clause for like, oh, no, we haven't really been in charge because there's, you know, the Illuminati are actually in charge. You know, you should blame them for everything.
Before we recorded you, you mentioned a few other, like, great examples of people just MPs just falling for bizarre things and introducing them into the House and therefore Hansard. Tony Antoniazzi talking about the old 5G, the old chestnut, and Nick Fletcher denouncing the international socialist concept of so-called 15-minute cities, which will cost us our personal freedom, which, you know, most people listening to this podcast will know that it's about ensuring you're no more than 15 minutes away from a dentist or a hospital or a pint of milk. They're not actually putting the gun towers up yet.
No, unless you need to get to a gun tower within 15 minutes, in which case, you know, well done. Yeah, no, this is one of the most bizarre things where you're looking at this going like, this is literally the most benign concept you can think of. It is, in fact, a very conservative policy. What if our big cities were more like sort of the small villages that you used to like with, you know, nuns cycling over the village green and, you know, whatever else it was. That
one punch John of beer, yes.
Yeah, John Major was going on about. Like, you know, literally, it's can we make our cities more like the kind of places you've been telling us we should be living all this time? And the idea that this is some kind of international socialist takeover is absolutely bizarre to me. The strangest thing about that is, I mean, you know, Nick Fletcher is, you know, not a particularly sort of prominent backbench Tory MP, but the actual transport minister, Mark Harper, tried to play both sides of going like, you know, sort of, you know, he said there's nothing wrong with making sure people can walk or cycle to the shops or school. What is sinister and what we shouldn't tolerate is the idea that local councils can decide how often you go to the shops and that they ration who uses the roads and when. Okay, good. Thank you, Mark Harper. Everybody's suggesting the first bit and nobody's suggesting the second bit. And it's that kind of thing. It's like, you know, sort of, he's aware that he can't sort of fully endorse this, but also he's trying to get a little bit of support from the people who do think it nonetheless. And yeah, as you said, yeah, sort of Tony Antoniazzi, the Labour MP, like she's been for quite some years now sort of very interested in 5G and electrosensitivity. The issue of that, like, you know, she led a debate about it in Parliament, I think in 2019, in which she sort of introduced it by saying that initiating a conversation about electromagnetic sensitivity has had members of my own team and family telling me that it is all made up.
Could yes, that be that's... because it's all made up?
Yeah, kind of. Yes. There is this kind of thing where, like, most MPs, when they approach conspiracy theories in this kind of way, they will walk up to the line, but they will rarely go quite over it, you know, sort of. So, you know, Tony Antoniazzi, you know, she was saying that she is just asking questions. She would like the government to make more data available. She would like to make sure that this has been studied properly. This is often the case that you see with MPs when they're talking about these conspiracy theories. They say that they are, you know, the classic phrase, just asking questions. And of course, to a certain extent, we do want our MPs to be able to ask questions in a free and unfettered way. Maybe the fact that they occasionally ask really dumb questions is the price that we pay for the fact that they can occasionally ask the important questions as well. So I don't know.
I mean, in our conversations before recording, you did admonish me not to neglect the conspiracy theories on the liberal and the left areas of our politics. Remainer conspiracy theories, you know, that maybe some of our listeners might, maybe even some of our hosts like me might have believed. the idea that the EU has secret plans to force the euro on everybody after 2022. The idea that Brexit was all a ploy to avoid new EU tax law, or it's all a ploy to short the stock market, or Cambridge Analytica did it all on its own. I mean, a lot of this was stuff that I've got to admit, you know, at the time in the chaos, I was thinking, this seems very plausible.
Yeah. And look, to be perfectly honest, like if it wasn't for the fact that during a long period of this, I was like literally editing a fact-checking website. So it was my job to go, is that true? Yeah, I'd probably have believed quite a bit of it as well. But yeah, Brexit was absolutely, again, very rarely was it sort of the full out and out, you know, lizard people on the moon kind of conspiracy theory. But it was this sort of undertow of conspiracism that kind of affected everything. So yeah, on the Leave side, you had this sort of thing. There was a viral bit about the Lisbon Treaty and how this would come into force and do all of these terrible things that just went absolutely everywhere. The Lisbon Treaty came into force in 2009 and it didn't do any of that. You know, the secret plans to force the euro on everyone, like Daniel Kaczynski, one of the MPs, he sort of pushed that one. And yeah, on the sort of the Remain side, yeah, sort of the idea that Cambridge Analytica played a major role in the Brexit vote, that was really common. I mean, we actually did some polling on this, me and John, and like that's a lot of people still believe that, even though it's basically come out that they weren't really involved. And yeah, as you say, sort of the idea that it was all a ploy to short the stock market, which, you know, literally sort of Philip Hammond, who had until very recently been the Chancellor of the Exchequer, he kind of sort of nodded at that in an article in the Times, kind of going like, you know, this was during the sort of the time when like it was, are we going to have a no deal Brexit or are we going to get a deal? And he said that, you know, crashing out without a deal is the only thing that will work for Johnson's donors. That's not how finance works.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
I mean, we are quite a way into the post-truth era, and to the extent that people don't even say post-truth anymore, do they? They've sort of fallen off the radar. Do we have to accept that conspiracy arguments and ideas like the ones we've just been talking are now just another weapon in the armory of politics as contact sport? It doesn't matter if it's true, as long as it's effective. So it doesn't matter that Lee Anderson is talking rubbish when he talks about his, you know, Sadiq Khan's imaginary Islamist mates, as long as he gets the result that he needs.
I mean, I think, you know, like to be clear, yeah, there is definitely a case where like using conspiracy theories can maybe get you access to a well of support that otherwise would not come out to vote for you. But, you know, from a purely cynical electioneering perspective, I can see that. So there is a cynical aspect to this. But honestly, I actually think the answer to this is no. I really think that this is not a weapon that is good to pick up. Yes, there's a moral case for that. These are dangerous. You know, when you suggest that simply by virtue of being Muslim, Sadiq Khan is in league with Islamists, that is dangerous. It is extremely dangerous. When you suggest that Israel deliberately allowed the October 7th attack to happen, that is dangerous. But beyond that, conspiracy theories are not, in fact, about reality. And ultimately, you can try and get elected as much as you want. If you do, you're going to have to govern. And you're going to have to govern about the real world rather than the imaginary world. And so I think for any politician who's tempted to sort of pick up conspiracy theory and sort of just wield it as a weapon that won't come back to bite them, I think that's incredibly foolish, because ultimately reality has a tendency to reinforce itself. Mm. And if you are constantly fighting imaginary enemies, you're never going to actually have any achievements that you can point to and go like, look, that's what I did. The lives of your constituents are not going to get better. And you're going to have to just double down and double down on inventing new imaginary enemies who stopped you doing the thing you wanted to do the time before. It isn't ultimately a winning strategy. It might get you an election win once, twice, but it's not going to last you for the long term because it's not real.
So why are we seeing so much of it now? Because, I mean, I think in my life, I've never seen such twaddle advanced on legitimate platforms.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I found a study on the use of the phrase conspiracy and conspiracy theory in Parliament over a past century. It is the case that accusations of conspiracy have declined until sort of fairly recently, and accusations of conspiracy theory have increased. So the way it's used, like sort of, I think it was 1965 is the first time the term conspiracy theory is used in Parliament, in some debate in the Lords about whether or not the government was trying to get rid of the army reserves or something. It seemed a little bit conspiratorial, but not like absolutely howling at the moon stuff. Anyway, but the use of the phrase conspiracy theory as an attack line has grown. And as such, there's sort of been this pressure against MPs sort of going fully there. Even when they are talking about conspiracy theories, they'll normally begin it with, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but, because they're kind of having to get that out of the way. But yeah, no, it does feel like in sort of very recent years, I say, it's always been there as a sort of a baseline for an awful lot of politics on both the left and the right. It does feel like in recent years, there has been a real uptick in sort of the intensity of it, the number of different types of theory that are kind of coming to the forefront, and, you know, the extent to which they seem to be fully integrated into, you know, sort of not just individuals, but constituencies of those parties. You know, there are factions of political parties that have very conspiracist worldviews.
Is it just the all-purpose answer for everything bad? It's the internet, it's social media that's enabled this kind of stuff to fester and to spread, because I can't see what else has changed from the time before it was so common and now.
I mean, yes. I don't think there's any answer to this that doesn't involve the internet. I wouldn't say that it's all just internet.
Yeah.
There is definitely a thing. Like, I think, I don't know about you, I still have this image in my head that, like, our politicians have like a different information diet to me, like that they're reading more informed things than I am, and they're not. Like, this is something that I have definitely learned, you know, over sort of, you know, recent years. No, they're reading the exact same stupid Facebook minions memes as we are, and that is where they're getting their information from. So the internet is definitely part of it. Also, the pressure of the internet on the traditional media as well. I think that's a really, really huge part of it, is that you need to have an actual media ecosystem that, rather than reasserting reality, is happy to go off into fantasy. And I think you see that with an awful lot of, you know, especially on the right now, like, you know, the left is not innocent in this, but especially on the right, both in America and in the UK, you see sort of right-wing sources that are happy to indulge in just really wild stuff rather than, you know, doing the job of reporters going like, but is that actually true? And I think that plays a definite role in it. But then, you know, you've kind of got to look and say that there are a couple of things just about being a politician that really might sort of make you more likely to believe in conspiracy theories. For one thing, like, they are a group of people who are in fact plotters and schemers. Like, they're small scale, like, they're not doing full Illuminati stuff, but they are all sort of trying to work some little thing of, like, you know, power games within their party or stuff like that. Like, being a politician is to be surrounded by people who have secret agendas. That's probably going to condition your view a little bit. And then there's the other thing, which is simply that most politicians, contrary to what I think a lot of us think of them, do very firmly believe in their political beliefs. You know, the thing about people who are really strongly politically committed is that it's very hard to imagine why anybody would disagree with you. Like, you're so certain. And if you can't imagine how anybody could disagree, well, then the only alternative that's left is that they're doing it for corrupt, secret reasons. You know, they're being paid, or they're, you know, they've got some other hidden agenda that they're trying to go for rather than just their stated things. I honestly think an awful lot of conspiracy theory stuff in politics comes from just a simple failure to believe that actually your political opponents believe in the ideology that they espouse.
Yeah. And I suppose it's interesting to think that people who are among the 650 legislators of the country, you know, certainly amongst supposedly the most powerful people in the country, are as susceptible as the rest of us to the basic emotional pull of conspiracy theory, which is it makes sense of the world. It's an alternative to thinking that it's just chaos and stuff happens. It tells you that there's somebody in charge behind it. We might not know who they are. They might be evil. They might be connected in all sorts of kind of Simpson stone cutter ways. But at least they're there. And it's a way of thinking of the world that is not just like events will roll on and no one's in charge.
It seems counterintuitive, but it's absolutely true. And a load of research kind of backs it up. Even if the idea that an all-powerful secret group is in charge of the world and they want to microchip your family is scary, it is also comforting. It is comforting that there is a purpose and there is a plan and that all of this mess actually makes sense. And yeah, you see this really throughout all conspiracy theories, is that there's this attraction of a narrative that gives us a tidy story. Yeah. When, of course, reality doesn't work like that. And I think for politicians, that's very strong. Politicians, their job is to tell stories, you know? And the actual messy business of governing a country doesn't fit into those narratives very easily.
Yeah.
And so it's not surprising that they're attracted to it. You know the phrase, cock up, not conspiracy?
Yeah.
That's been a huge deal. The study I was talking about, looking at uses of conspiracy theory in Parliament, specifically called this out and said, like, for a long time, politicians were very, very keen to emphasize that it was cock-up, not conspiracy. And you can kind of see that they would actually have an interest in going like, we might make mistakes, but we're not evil. I think what we're seeing now is that we've got into an age where there's actually a lot of politicians who would rather believe that their opponents, or indeed even sometimes their colleagues, are evil rather than admit to the possibility of mistakes.
Yeah. Just finally, we're about to see a massive changeover in the political cast of characters and the political direction of the country. The Conservatives are going to disappear into what we could euphemistically call a period of reflection. Are you expecting a more conspiracist Conservative Party to emerge once they go into opposition? The con pop cons, perhaps?
It could go either way. And I think this is something that the Conservative Party as a whole should be taking quite seriously right now. There is the definite possibility that, much like Liz Truss, they look for somebody to blame that isn't them. Going into opposition always should require a party to reflect seriously. The reality is very often that they don't reflect seriously immediately. They go through a bit of flailing and go like, no, it wasn't our fault. Ah, we were betrayed. I think there is a real chance that the conspiracist wing might come into the ascendancy. I'm not sure they're the majority, but I'm not sure that there's enough of a majority to beat them, if that makes sense, because the rest of the party actually have their own factions and they might not be able to agree on stuff enough to kind of beat out the more conspiracist wing. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting to look at. As I said, like, their media environment right now is very different from any previous time that the Conservatives have gone into opposition. There's a lot of media outlets that will be very happy to indulge the most paranoid interpretations of events. So they're going to have to be very careful.
Oh, good. I am so looking forward to that. Tom Phillips, thank you for joining me to discuss conspiracy theory and the secretive figures behind it. Who are the secretive figures spreading this conspiracy theory? It's been a really interesting conversation.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Listeners, you can buy Conspiracy, A History of Bollocks Theories and How Not to Fall for Them from our affiliate bookshop. There is a link in the show notes and we at The Bunker will get a small cut. So as you see, everything is connected. And if you want to contribute to a real conspiracy, why not consider backing The Bunker on Patreon? Because of the mismanagement of the economy, we need your support more than ever. The ad market is drying up as the recession bites. So your help is incredibly valuable. You'll help us to keep the lights on in The Bunker and to pay our hungry young producers. Anything you can contribute from as little as £3 a month is very much appreciated. So check the link in the show notes or search Patreon Bunker Podcast. I've been Andrew Harrison. I'm just asking questions. Thanks for listening. We'll be back tomorrow with another bunker if they let us. See you then.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fearn, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker was written and presented by Podmasters Group Editor Andrew Harrison. The producer was Eliza Davis Beard, and the audio producer was me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by Jim Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.